I have really enjoyed the opportunity to get to know via the wonders of Facebook a very good friend of my brother Steve, who lives in Philadelphia. And he has come to befriend and likes very much a young man by the name of Daniel Maurer. And Daniel Maurer is a very talented writer and producer of graphic novels, among other things, and a former pastor, as a matter of fact. And we're going to be talking today on The Morning Show about several different publications, which I've had the chance to explore over the last several days, and about Daniel Maurer's work in trying to help people find real and authentic transformation in their lives. He has a website and blog called Transformation is Real. And this is much more than just empty rhetoric for Daniel Maurer. Daniel Maurer is someone who had to wrestle with some very self-destructive demons involving addiction. And the fact that he emerged from that whole and ready to live the rest of his life says a lot about why this kind of work is so very, very important for him. We're going to be talking about that and about three different publications. One of them is called Sobriety, and it's a graphic novel written by Daniel Maurer, which takes us into the 12-step program. The most recent publication is another graphic novel called Papa Luther, which actually looks at the life and work of Martin Luther. And there is also a book called Far Away, A Suburban Boy's Story as a Victim of Sex Trafficking, which is co-written by Daniel Maurer. It's the story of someone else who experienced something especially terrible as a young adolescent boy. And it is a powerful story, which Daniel Maurer has really helped to bring before the public. So we have a lot to talk about. So without further ado, Daniel Maurer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Gregory, it's wonderful to be here. And first of all, I have to say I'm really impressed that you pronounced my last name correctly. So,
well, I had a voice student with the last name of Maurer. So there you go. That's the only reason I can say that. So we probably need to begin with your life story, because I don't think anything that we talk about after that will make perfect sense unless we really have a sense of who you are and what you have been through, which helps us understand why this work of helping people transform is so important.
I'm going to give your listeners the quick version, because generally when I speak publicly, this is a stretch out to give a little bit more detail. But I grew up in suburban Minneapolis in Anoka, north of the Twin Cities. Had a good family. Lived in Germany for a little over a year as a high school student. I was a high achiever. I was a triple major at Concordia College in Moorhead, mathematics, German, and economics. And after doing all that, I decided that I was called to be in ministry. So I became an ELCA pastor. My wife and I and our two kids, we lived north of Bismarck, North Dakota. And I discovered very soon after that I didn't really want to be doing this anymore, but I felt trapped. I struggled with depression, with boredom, the way that I dealt with it. I drank. First it was in the afternoon, and then it was at about noon, and then it was much more convenient to do that in the morning, because when, by the time my wife came home and I ate pickles to cover up the smell on my breath, it seemed to be something that was functioning in my life. And yeah, so that really progressed to the point where I went to treatment three different times. The last time I went was because of an incident that happened. I had taken benzodiazepines and alcohol and completely blacked out. And multiple times just decided it was a good idea to walk into other people's homes to see if they had pills. It was awful. And as I was standing in the basement jail cell with an anti-suicide smock on, I asked myself, how did I get to this point? And I think really what happened after that is I had to question the decisions that I had made in my life. And I also had to acknowledge that I was somebody that was chemically dependent. And finally, I got sober. I got sobriety. When I was at Hazelden, believe it or not, I had a dream the third month that I was there to produce a graphic novel. And maybe some of your listeners don't know what that is. It's just a big, fat comic book. And I wanted to produce this to show people what recovery is like in the 12 steps. And took the idea to Hazelden Publishing, and they rejected it at first. I got an artist. We produced 10 pages. The second time, they were very interested in it, but decided, no, we can't do this. We don't think it's going to work. And then the third time when I brought it there, we had produced that much more. And they finally said at that point, yes, this is something that we need, especially for youth and young adults, to communicate what recovery is about. And since then, I've made my nonfiction brand about transformation. It's not only about personal transformation. As you see, my first two books, Sobriety and Far Away, but it's also about societal transformation, and I had the great honor to be a part of a compendium of works that Augsburg Fortress Publishers in Minneapolis are producing for the 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Church, and this too is a graphic novel. This is for kids, but the great thing about graphic novels is that anybody of any age can read these, not only enjoy them, but understand them. What's one interesting thing about the medium of comics, researchers have done functional MRI studies, and they have shown that when you have pictures and text together, that there's actually more retained than any other medium out there, more learned, and the comprehension level is much higher. So it's been a gift to be able to do this, and it's just absolutely a blast to write. I tell you what, Greg, it's sort of like writing a screenplay because you give instructions to the artist, and then you have the dialogue that goes along with it. So my life's really been a gift, and I'm very, very grateful.
Of course, what's really interesting about your story is that it makes perfect sense once it exists, but you have to persuade certain people, certain publishers, that yes, it makes sense for somebody to create a graphic novel about sobriety or about the 12-step program. And as you delineated, it wasn't an easy sell. And we can kind of understand why. It's a serious topic. And if somebody doesn't understand the artistic potential of graphic novels, if they hear the word thick comic book, I mean, they think of Wonder Woman and other things that don't necessarily have a lot to do with this kind of story being told.
Precisely. That's one of the things that I think that comics, they really get a bad rap. People think, yes, ma'am, I'll save you. Either that, or when you say graphic novel, they don't know what it is, and they think it's it's this graphic, terrible stuff. It's like a slasher novel. So part of it is a marketing issue that's there. But they're finding now even educators in some states are using comic books to teach kids. I mean, think about that. My father, who grew up in the Black Hills of South Dakota, one of the things he told me when he got a comic book, his grandmother would say to him, kid, that's going to rot your brain. You know, they don't understand that actually he was learning more by doing that.
Wow. We're speaking with Daniel Maurer, who is a writer and producer of a couple of different graphic novels. We're going to be talking about those and about a very powerful book which he co-wrote called Far Away. Ahead of us talking about that, I want to just circle back to the life story that you were sketching out and the fact that you began your adult professional life as a clergyman, but in your words, roughly, figured out pretty quickly that this was maybe not actually for you. And I'm just curious because I think that's one of the most difficult situations that someone can find themselves in is when they have devoted years of their life and a lot of energy and heart to training to become something, only to realize once they get there that I'm not sure this is what I actually should have become. and it can be for a lot of different reasons, of course. But I think it's also different when you decide you don't want to be an accountant anymore versus when you decide you don't want to be a pastor anymore. I wonder if you could just say a word about, in a sense, the nature of your discontent. Was it that being a pastor was okay, but maybe not in rural North Dakota, or that the work in fact, actually was not what you expected it to be and not fully satisfying, or just what was going on there, and how difficult was it for you to step away from that life?
Well, I think that's a wonderfully articulated question, and a fair one. I think many people, what they find in their lives is that they end up going a certain direction, and then later on they find out that maybe that wasn't the direction that they should have gone. I think one of the things that my spirituality gives me today, and I'm not in your face at all with anyone about spirituality, religion, or any of that, but how it works for me and where I find meaning and purpose is that there aren't necessarily any mistakes in life. There's only experience. In many ways, I mean, there's neither good nor bad things that happen. There's bad choices that you make. There's things that we can do that hurt other people. And those things I regret very much. But I would not trade my past at this point for anything. I wish I hadn't done the bad things that I did. I wish I didn't hurt people. But when I look back in my past on what has happened and the choices that I made to become a pastor, I don't regret that at all. I love my seminary education. It's given me the theological acumen to move forward. And certainly it's given me an understanding of what transformation and change, personal change, is about. So when I look back into that, I have no regrets.
Let's talk for a moment about your decision to write about the topic of sobriety within the format of a graphic novel. First of all, it has to be a little bit daunting to take on this kind of topic in any format. I mean, to write about it, and also to sort of sort out how much of this is going to be about my experience, my journey to sobriety, versus the journey that others experience. Just tell us a little bit about how you wrestled with this challenge of how best to write about something so important and, in a sense, something so potentially complex.
Yeah, one of the unique things about Dan Maurer is I take on projects that I have no idea how to do them, but I sort of figure it out along the way. But here's one of the things that I've recognized in myself. I love being a writer. It's very hard work. It's hard to make a living at doing this. There's very few people that do that, but I am a freelance writer today, and I make a living doing this. Writers are noticers, and your job as a writer is to articulate in a creative format what you have noticed and to give purpose and meaning to the other person. And our stories, our narrative, that's what really makes a difference for any of us, because all of us have a story. One of the things I'm doing right now with the production of my fourth book, which I haven't mentioned yet, is on the topic of resilience, that is, of people's ability to bounce back in life. And this book is going to be looking at different spiritual assets, which are nothing more than virtues like courage or honesty. And I've been writing different people's stories in the first person. And one of the stories that I interviewed was of a woman who was down in Mississippi, and she was attacked by her husband. And he attacked her with a machete and nearly killed her. And we identified in her chapter her spiritual asset to bouncing back was gratitude. And one of the things I found in sharing her story and laying it out, and this isn't a graphic novel, by the way, this is just a regular prose work, and but the process is very similar to what writing a graphic novel is about. You just add into the graphic novel, the comics, you have to add in the pictures that you already see in your mind. And what I do with a regular, just a book with just words, is I try to paint a picture in the canvas of your mind, the reader. And so I think kind of the question, to answer your question, I have an added layer that I want to describe, that a graphic novel I give instructions to the artist to put stuff down on the page that you see, but I'm still trying to paint a picture about what it's about. And what I try to capture in sobriety, and really in any book, is the main point that I want to bring across, and that is transformation is real. It's possible. This can happen in a person's life. And really all of my works, they have that transformational aspect to them.
A transformation is not just a myth, but
yeah,
it is something
real. Change happens. You know what? It's funny that you mentioned that word myth, because I remember once I was at a seminar when I was a pastor. I think it was a Synod gathering. And the speaker was up front, and I remember him saying, "You just got to remember, people don't change." Well, you know, if I believe that, I would just give up today. People they don't like to change always, but people can, and they do change. And it's possible to make these changes in our lives so that we then, once again, have purpose and meaning.
Before we talk about your graphic novel, Sobriety, can you just say a quick word about your own journey to sobriety? Mm-hmm. And what kind of a journey that was, and in a sense, how that informs the way that you think about it and talk about it.
Yeah, could you ask that question again? I need you to spell out what that is. It's a bit broad.
Yeah. I want to know more specifics about what your path to sobriety was. I mean, and was it a... I mean, I think, you know, sometimes we're tempted to draw them on a graph geometrically, that it was a precipitous fall and then a slow climb upwards versus a big zigzag. Or, I mean, what kind of a journey was this for you? How many dead ends were there or wrong turns before?
I think like many people, it was bumpy. There's lots of relapses. I went to inpatient treatment 3 times. I went to many, many outpatients, saw a psychotherapist, did all sorts of things. What I needed to learn is that I needed to be crushed. You know, I needed to fall and fall hard. I needed a rock hard bottom. And for me, that was in the basement of a Williams County jail cell with an anti-suicide smock on, asking myself, how did I get to this place? Because that was never my intention to get to that place. One of the things about addiction that when I speak publicly, I share that no one ever starts out the addiction thinking that they're going to go and they're going to end up in that place, you know, in the basement cell of a Williams County jailhouse, or with a wrecked car, or, you know, killing somebody while they were driving drunk. I mean, nobody ever wants to go to those places. Addiction is an absolute plague, especially in our country, and we need to address it in ways, and especially address the stigma that's associated with it, because I do genuinely believe that it is a disease. Now, why? Because the brain is in an organ, just like the heart or the foot or the kidney. The brain is an organ, and the brain can also be diseased. In this case, with chemical use, I call it an induced mental illness, because you add something into it. You have a genetic component, you have a bodily reaction, you have a mental reaction, and you have a spiritual reaction. And it went to pretty bad places. I was not really happy, obviously, but it ended up for good, and I do genuinely believe that. This is always hard for me to say, because I wonder what people are out there who have experienced, you know, things on the other side that addicts have done. You know, maybe somebody was a store owner and they had their place broken into, or maybe somebody had a son or a daughter was killed by a drunk driver. And I feel so pained that they have to go through that pain also. At the same time, I realize that transformation is possible for people. And if we don't give them the opportunity or the ability to get sober, to change their lives, then that's never going to happen. Now, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be ramifications, especially legal ramifications. In my case, the legal system was very, very positive. It changed me into a better person, I think. Not so with everybody, especially with thousands of mostly black men who end up incarcerated because they didn't have enough money to pay for a lawyer. But that's another topic.
So for you, I assume you experienced the road to sobriety through the 12-step program that we I was going to say we hear so much about. It's actually interesting how most of us have only the vaguest notion of what those 12 steps are. In fact, I'm pretty sure I've never really known the 12 steps until I read your graphic novel called Sobriety. So in a sense, it's something that's happening all around us. But
The book worked.
but it's happening in a sense in private. I mean, behind closed doors for the most part, or at least that's how we tend to think of it. So first of all, did the 12 steps work for you? I mean, to some extent, it sure seems like. I mean, you are sober now, but is it because of those 12 steps, or was that just a format within which some other kind of even more profound transformation occurred?
Well, I live in the state of Minnesota, but there's an organization that we have here called Minnesota Recovery Connection, and I believe very firmly in their mission and goal, and that is to give many different individuals the sobriety that they need through different modalities of recovery. And that means that there are things beyond 12 steps. Rational recovery, a lot of people, they do get sober on their own. I mean, it's a sort of the elephant in the room for a lot of 12-step meetings. Some people do that. I follow the traditions of the 12 steps, and I attend a 12-step group. And the reason why I do that is I have found that it works. I didn't always believe that. I mean, the first treatment around, I thought it was a cult. You know, I didn't want anything to do with it. Second time around, I kind of wanted to get sober, but I didn't know how to do it, and I certainly didn't work it. This time around, I've committed to it, and now I want to go. I want to reach out, not only for the community that I have in my meetings that I attend, but the way that I reach out to others to help and to advocate that transformation is real.
One of the hallmarks of this graphic novel called Sobriety is that we meet an array of people going through the 12-step program, and just about all of them, in one way or another, either have issues with it or had issues with it. I mean, struggled with various facets of it. In almost no case does it seem like, in a sense, like a flawless fix or easy fix. But in fact, it is a process that is fraught with all kinds of challenges for each of these characters. Just say a word about why you wanted to talk about the 12-step program in this way. Because I think a lot of people who want people to experience it might be tempted to paint, in a sense, a rosier picture of just what smooth sailing it is. That's not the picture. That's not the story you tell here.
No. Remember, writers are noticers. And something that I notice is that life is very gray. It's not black and white. So I wanted to paint that picture that with many, many different tones of lots of different experiences, at least within the characters that I have there. Larry is the old timer, and he sort of has the longest story in there. And I had to fight to keep that character in there because one of the things that younger people find when they enter into the rooms is they experience these old timers, and they say, "Well, what connection do I have with this 65-year-old guy or this 70-year-old woman? I mean, they're from a different generation." Well, people are people, and the human condition does not change, and the 12 steps doesn't meet everybody where they're at. I know, at least in St. Paul, Minnesota here, the Hmong community has a very difficult time understanding the concept of a higher power. That really doesn't work. And Bill Wilson, the guy who wrote the big book of AA, he had a very patriarchal, male, 1930s, 1940s understanding of life. Now, I have at least a theological training where I can kind of put him in his own context. But the picture that I wanted to paint in Sobriety, and indeed with all my books, is I want it to be real so that people, when they read these stories, they say, "Yeah, this really happened. I get what you're trying to say."
Talk for a moment about the various characters, in a sense, that you created for Sobriety, a graphic novel. And how tricky was that in terms of figuring out what facets of this experience to describe?
That's kind of a funny question, because we sure covered the gamut. Larry is the white middle class, maybe a working class guy who's from St. Paul, Minnesota, in his late 60s. He's been to Vietnam. And then the rest of the characters, Alex, we have a gay atheist of African descent who's from the UK and is an ecstasy addict. You know, Debbie, who comes from the Fort Myers region of Florida, kind of has more evangelical background, and that's her understanding of how it works. Matt is completely Debbie's opposite. He's from the San Diego area, and he's a meth addict. And then we have Hannah, who's an adopted person of Asian descent from small-town Wisconsin. And of course, you know, when you work with an editor, they say, "Well, we got to cover lots of demographics, and it has to be something for everybody." Okay, well, sure. So maybe that's contrived, but it's also very real, because these are different experiences that people have. And I think that the way that we learn is by having empathy with the characters that are on a page, and they are fictional characters there. The nonfiction of my brand is that it is real, and that's what I want to write. I want to write real things that people can understand and access easily.
I wonder, in your own experience as you went through the 12 steps, were there particular steps that were particularly difficult for you?
Oh, boy, that's a huge answer. Yeah. All of them. I
mean, okay.
In some ways, I still don't know what steps 6 and 7 really are. It's like, well, it's a repeat of one and two, or 2 and 3. I don't really know how to answer that. I mean,
well, that's an answer in and of itself. It really is. I mean, that tells us a lot about it. One other thing I want to ask you is, I think. I really have no idea where the 12 steps came from. I mean, who and when and where this system was created. But I suspect that if you put a lot of smart people in a room who care about this topic, I have a feeling that a lot of people would weigh in and say, you know, if you really want this to be effective, you maybe shouldn't have 12 steps. You know, maybe it should be 3, or maybe it should be 6, but 12 steps is a lot to, in a sense, kind of keep track of. And maybe for someone, that just sounds like a really intimidating gauntlet that they don't want to enter in the first place.
I've thought that too. I thought, well, why didn't they make it 10? Then you could have one for each finger. we don't have 12 fingers.
Right.
I think the founders, when they put this together, and a lot of this comes from a lot of 19th century evangelical thinking, and there's a deeper movement behind that. And let me tell you, I'm neither an AA nor a 12-step scholar. I'm a writer. And what that means, I'm trying to tell stories, real stories, transformational stories. So when you look at the steps and traditions of different 12-step groups, I think some people are going to get something out of it, and out of each one that's there. And maybe that was part of the purpose, is like, well, you don't have to get them all. You know, take the good and leave the rest. I mean, it's another sort of an AA-ism that you hear quite a bit. I mean, we could have a whole book just for AA-isms, because they got a lot of them. But I think that for me, that really has value. That means that, you know, you can understand the things that you understand, and just let others be, because that is what life is about. We have different experiences. Learn to have empathy. Learn to see something from another person's perspective. That's what I try to do as a writer, and that's why I try to tell real stories that transform people's lives.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with a very gifted writer by the name of Daniel D. Moyer, who's responsible for a graphic novel called Sobriety, inspired at least in part by his own real-life experiences as emerging from very serious substance abuse and addiction into a life of sobriety. A more recent graphic novel called Papa Luther, based on the life and work of Martin Luther. And he's also responsible for a book called Far Away, A Suburban Boy's Story as a Victim of Sex Trafficking. The background of this particular book is particularly fascinating. I want you to tell our listeners about the circumstances under which you met this person named Kevin Kline and how you became ultimately aware of his amazing and disturbing personal story.
Well, Kevin and I were friends in seminary. At the time, the LCA had the policy that openly gay or lesbian pastors could not serve in an ordained function. So when he told me that he was gay, when he outed himself to me, it not only was a great honor, but it was a sign of trust. And our friendship grew throughout the years, and as my addiction worsened, he was one of the people that I reached out to, and I have to credit some things that he said to me. I remember the second time I went to treatment, I was just going through withdrawal, and I didn't want to go to treatment again, but I didn't know what to do, and he said to me, "Dan, sometimes you have to do things that you don't want to do." And little would I know later on what he would reveal to me, an experience that he had in 1975 St. Louis when he was 14 years old. He was basically pimped out by an older man who seduced him and then enticed him and then sold him out. And when Kevin told me the story, it was the most powerful story of transformation and redemption that I have ever heard. And so when I finally approached him to write this book, and I said, you know, you should really write a book on this. There's a lot about human trafficking right now, but very, very little from boys' perspective. He said, no way, I'm not doing that. Then some people at Warburg Seminary, a mentor of his, she encouraged him and said, yeah, I think you should do that. So eventually we sat down together. He gave me his journals. He's not a writer, but he has a story. So what I then attempted to do, and I think I achieved, was I wrote it in the first person, his perspective of what had happened. And we had two contributors, Dr. Rick Curtis and Anthony Marcus from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City that wrote the afterword for it. Far Away, that book, I'm very proud of it because it shares the story of boys who haven't had their story told in so many years. Nobody acknowledges them. Kind of the narrative out there right now, Greg, is that with human trafficking and underage prostitution, people say, oh, these poor young girls. And you know what? Girls, they are the majority of cases, but there is a large minority. And in fact, they did a study on the East Coast, and they found a very large minority, almost 50% of the subjects that they spoke with on the East Coast were boys or transgendered youth. And nobody is telling their story. You know, and these kids, they deserve to have a life. They deserve to have their story told. And that's what I've done with this book.
One of the most powerful elements of the story of young Kevin is of the intense bond which he experiences with a couple of the other boys who are caught up in this same life. And it's really important for us to see that because it helps us understand why somebody who could have easily extricated themselves from this chose not to. In the sense that, I mean, some people find themselves, maybe mistakenly, but believe that this is something they simply must do, and the circumstances of life just sort of draw them into this nightmare. But Kevin was living a very normal life otherwise with a loving family out in the suburbs.
Yeah.
And sort of fell into this by accident in a sense, and then the bonds of friendship were what kept him there. I wonder if you could just say a word about that element of the story and how significant it is in us understanding kind of the larger picture here.
Excellent question. I think that it relates directly to the previous topic that you have of addiction to, how easily we dance on the head of a pin, moralizing, looking into others' lives and saying, well, why didn't you choose this? You know, 14-year-old boy, you could have just gone home. You could have never called your pimp ever again. You could have lived your life. Why didn't you do that? And it's the same question that I think that some people moralize to drug addicts and alcoholics. You idiot, why don't you just stop drinking? Can't you see? Just don't drink, or quit drinking so much. Stop it. It's just that easy. And it's incomprehensible for people outside of it to understand how difficult those choices really are, and that really the option of choice is taken away from us. Kevin, as a gay teen in the mid-70s, had no one else to go to. Parents didn't come together and plan a prom that included gay boys or lesbian girls. And, you know, it's one of the things that we brought out in the story. Kevin relates a story when he was young in suburban St. Louis, Florissant, Ferguson, up in the North County. And he remembers that there were two lesbian women that were living nearby, and either some boys or hooligans or something, they tried to light a fire and burn down their house. Well, the police came and they just sort of shake their heads and they took down a few notes, and that was that. Nobody really tracked him down anymore because people didn't care about him. These people are throwaways. Well, that's the judgment I think that society places on them. But I don't. I want to tell their story just as I want to tell my story too.
One of the most difficult things to understand is how someone like Kevin could be engaging in this kind of behavior and his parents have no idea that any of this was going on. And I don't know if part of that is maybe a reality of back in the summer of 1975, maybe the means by which a parent might know what their kids were engaged in is different now. I mean, with Facebook and other things. But I wonder if you've thought very much about that, about the way in which this story played out at a certain point in time that is very different from the reality of today.
Yes. So, I mean, there's no doubt that we have a different cultural milieu right now. However... Are there things that my kids do, my two boys, that I don't know about? I mean, were there things that you did that your parents didn't know about? Well, I mean, that's part of growing up. I mean, that something as big as this, we would hope that we would know about it. And certainly, I'm not advocating that it was okay. You know, it was very painful for him. But knowing Kevin well enough, as well as I do, I would say this: if he would look back into his past, and would he take any of it away? I don't know. I don't know if he could. I mean, first of all, that's a magic wand that we can never wave, and so it's a bit hypothetical to say it. But it's the same. It's the same with me too. Our brokenness makes us who we are. It can either break us completely and destroy us, or we can fuse those parts of brokenness back together. There's a wonderful allegory that I use when I speak publicly, not only about the story of Far Away, but also sobriety. And it is the process of kintsugi, which is a Japanese art form of pottery. And the potter, what she does, or he does, is they take the broken shards of a piece that they dropped mistakenly, and then they glue it back together with gold seams, and thereby aggrandizing and highlighting the brokenness of that piece. And the final piece, what you have, and you're looking on this line, kintsugi, is a work of pottery that's beautiful. despite its brokenness, because of its brokenness. And I think that's precisely, I think, that's what Kevin, how he'd answer that, and that's how I answer it too. Things happen because they happen. There's only experience.
I wonder if you could say a word about what this was like for Kevin himself to relive some of these experiences, and what was your role as the co-author here in terms of, for instance, drawing stories out of him or certain details or shaping the story? I mean, what kind of experience was this for him and for the two of you?
Well, I can speak for myself first. It was daunting. I'll tell you why. Because I'm a straight man, and Kevin is a gay man, a healthy gay man today. And when I first was going to be writing his story, one of the things the editorial team gave us, they said, you know, you've got to really you show your readers these scenes, these love scenes, because Kevin had fallen in love with his friend, Squirrel, he's called in the book. And the editor wanted us to show a scene of them kissing, you know. And I felt really uncomfortable about that at first. I mean, it was like, well, what do I do? But then, you know, what I noticed is after I wrote it, it's like, well, these are just two human beings. And it doesn't really matter what gender they are. What matters is the love bond that they had for each other. And as a 14-year-old, it's puppy love, yes. You know, it's wonderful. It's exciting. But that's the same thing, I think, for heterosexual couples is for homosexuals. I mean, Kevin, with his story, I really had to draw a lot of the tough stuff out of him. Now, you know, the book is by no means pornographic, you know, but it's real, you know. One of the first descriptions that I have in there is a middle-aged man, a lawyer, when Kevin is first delivered. And this man gave him something to eat, asked him if Kevin was ready, and then promptly took him up to his son's room, and that's where they had sex. You know, how messed up is that? And but this is something that Kevin has kept in his mind for so many years, and there's been so much shame associated with it. When he first told me, I think he was much, much more nervous about sharing this story than about whether or not that he was simply gay.
Right.
This was something that stuck with him forever, and it is very harmful. Now, that's the ironic thing. That's what'll cook your noodle once again. Would he trade his past? I don't know. Squirrel and Stevie, that friendship that they have, that's something precious.
Right.
And I wouldn't trade it for anything.
In the same way that a soldier that experiences something terribly brutal and traumatic, nevertheless feels this in unbreakable bond.
I tell you, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it's a beautiful segue to mention one of the stories that I have in my fourth book about resilience. Is I share an American soldier's story, and he did so anonymously because some of the things that he mentions in there, he could get in trouble with his superior officers. But yeah, he comes from a Cherokee background. He's an American soldier. Was Cherokee. And one of the things he taught me was something called Cherokee harmony ethic. And what that basically is active acceptance. That's what I call it within the chapter, active acceptance. It means that trauma, stress, bad things that happen in life, from a Cherokee understanding, is that you don't push them away or try to even compartmentalize them, which is what the military teaches. He said, instead, I welcome it in. I don't go out and seek out bad things. I don't go out and cause pain. But when something bad happens, I welcome it in. I make it a part of me. I weave it into who I am as a human being. And then what I do is I try to weave it back into the world. And you know, the Cherokees and many Native Americans have these beautiful images of woven things, much like a water flowing through a stream going around the rocks. What a person tries to do who understands this ethic is they try to give empathy then back into the world and to become a better place.
Wow. That's kind of what this is all about, isn't it?
It is. It's about transformation. It's about change. It's about having empathy, purpose, meaning for the world. You know, one of the things I read when I was in treatment, I was given two books. One was a graphic novel, believe it or not, by my father. It was a graphic novel called Logic Comics, which, believe it or not, its subject is Bertrand Russell's attempt to prove the foundations of mathematics. Doesn't that sound exciting? But it was actually very, very good, and that was the inspiration that was that I used for sobriety and how that worked. The other book that was given to me was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, a dinky little book. Now, Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychiatrist who was put in internment camp, a concentration camp, Auschwitz. And what he wanted to test while he was there was he wanted to see if people who found purpose and meaning for their lives, whether or not that made any difference. And after the war, when he survived this, he ascertained that, yes, if you have purpose and meaning in your life, you have a better chance of survival. You know, he developed this into something called logotherapy, which surprisingly hasn't been accepted within mainstream psychiatry or psychology. I don't know why, because it's very powerful. My purpose and meaning in life is to tell real stories that transform other people and that are transformative in their own right. That's what my nonfiction brand is. That's why all of my books, I'm trying to share what a difference life makes, because, Greg, stories are everywhere. Everyone has a story.
We want to mention that your latest publication is a graphic novel about none other than Martin Luther. You mentioned the special anniversary, which is sort of prompting the publication of a number of different works about him. In just a minute or so, just say a word about the way in which you wanted to tell this particular story.
Yeah, the 500th anniversary comes up this next year in 2017, 1517, is a commemoration of the Protestant Reformation and what Martin Luther did. What we tried to show through this book is his story through his kids' eyes, because we wanted to tell the story so that children, when they pick it up, it's accessible. Lots of people know Martin Luther's story, but what did his kids go through? Now, one of the surprising things that I found out is that his kids themselves have a wonderful story. Now, some of it is fictional content that I had to use to fill in, but the main basic thrust is that he loved his children deeply. And I also tell Katie's story, too, because many people out there haven't lifted up hers as well.
I wonder if you could also say a very, very brief word about your website, transformationisreal.com. In particular, the writings of other people that we find there.
Yeah, I think that's the greatest things about it. And by the way, anybody can find it much easier. Type in changesreal, one word, .com. That's much easier than transformation-is-reel.com.
Right.
Yeah, so, I invite others to share their stories of change, and you'll find all sorts of good things in there. One of the greatest things for me is when I read those, they're so inspiring, and it leads me to change my life for the better, too.
So changesreal.com will bring you to Daniel Maurer's website, where he in various ways explores the reality of true transformation in people's lives. And again, there are three different publications we want to remind you about. The really powerful memoir, Far Away, co-written by Daniel Maurer and R.K. Klein, whose experience is the backbone of the book, a graphic novel called Sobriety, which explores the 12-step program, and finally, most recently, Papa Luther, which explores the life and work of Martin Luther, and Daniel D. Maurer, responsible for them all. Daniel Maurer, it was a great pleasure to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and for all of the good work that you're doing.
This has been delightful. Thank you very much.